Onyx, the triumph of justice.
Have you anything to say for yourself why the court should not judge you according to the law? The court registrar asked. How could this be the law? Was this the law Moses of old meant? No, this cannot be. Aldo remembered he'd been asked to say something. What could a 17-year-old boy say at this point? God is my witness that I did not murder Sheikh Yusuf Usman. Aldo pleaded. Aldo Sabo, you've been given a fair trial and found guilty. Having examined the mass of evidence I have before me, I have no hesitation in concluding that you have been properly convicted. Sheikh Yusuf Usman was a very wealthy man with large hectares of land. He built his mighty mansions on some, and the rest he used for the cultivation of groundnut and cotton. He had 15 wells, but unluckily where he dug there was little water. During the dry season, the wells dried up, only springing forth at the visit of the first rain. Rano Town had good fertile soils, good for groundnut and cotton cultivation, and being located in the northern part of Nigeria, had a longer period of dry season. His subjects established a saying, as dry as Yusuf's wells. Many people had no privilege to own wells, but the few who had were not as unlucky as Sheikh Yusuf. They dug wells with ever-flowing waters. Among these few was Malam Gobir Sabu. Gobir dug 3 wells beside one of Yusuf's farms. These aroused a deep jealousy in Yusuf, so that they never saw eye to eye. Days passed, months passed, years passed. But the day willed by God to rupture the thread-like cord that binds man and his creator, the day when man shall see his endless eternity, must surely come, the day when the die is cast. On that day, Aldo strolled to his father's wells to drink from the labor of his father. Then came the sheikh from behind him. Son of my enemy, go back to your poverty-stricken family and drink from the wrinkled palm of your sick mother. Whose well is it? Aldo asked, not turning back to see the evil face of this incorrigible man. What sort of question is this? Aldo continued drinking the water when suddenly an arrow was shot at him. Without delay, Aldo bent down and the arrow thudded right into the sheikh's heart. After much struggle by his men to save him, he closed his eyes in death. The judge, who had been bribed to his face, now shamelessly referred to a mass of evidence. What evidence had he? No doubt the mass of evidence was the bags of coins he had been given. I cannot be too drastic in an offense of this nature. I should be failing in my duty to the public if I give you the option of a fine or a prison sentence. So, having found you guilty of murdering the sheikh, you are hereby sentenced to death by hanging. Court! The court clerk shouted, and Aldo's world came crashing before his very eyes. Aldo was led away from the dock by the policemen while his relatives wailed and dashed themselves to the ground. The scene at the court was one to behold. In the town of Ranu, there lived an upright man, very trustworthy, full of principle. He had a reputable character and was highly favored. Due to his ethical character, he was made to govern the prison and he was also the executioner. His name was Malam Zongo. As Aldo was led to the gallows, he said his final prayers. May the Lord have mercy on my soul, and may justice prevail against injustice. When he was about to be hanged, Malam Zongo said, young boy, your case is a very critical one. Why did your patience cease? My son, you go to meet your creator. What shall you say to him? And at this point, Malam Zongo looked into Audu's eyes and recognized him. Are you Audu, the only son of late Malam Gobir Sabo? Yes, Malam, I am, replied Audu. Malam Zongo refused to take further actions. I will not hang you. go back to police custody, for I will testify as a witness in court. Sorrows and tears may last for the night, but true joy comes in the morning. There was clamor, heated discussion, and last-minute consultations going on in the court when the judge entered. Order! Court! The court clerk bellowed while everybody rose up until the judge took his seat. Two policemen led the accused into the dock and then stood on either side of him as if he would escape. This time around, there was the counsel for the defense, Barrister Sani Aruga, a close friend of Malam Zongo. The first son of the Sheikh, Barrister Mahmoud Usman, served as the counsel for the prosecution. Justice Mandori was ill, so a new judge acted on his behalf. The new judge was Justice Tony Effiong. The witness on Audu's side was Malam Zongo.
It would be useless observing all protocols since everyone knows the reason for this gathering.
The court registrar announced.
Counsel for the defense, state why the accused is guilty.
Barrister Mahmoud, a slender, handsome young man in a white wig, stood up. My lord, members of the jury, my father's guards are not children. They said that Audi came with his friends to drink, boasting of his father's wealth. When they were confronted, they found the arrow on the ground, took it and shot at the sheikh. The guards at this time were working on the farm. Those guards returned and saw their master in a pool of blood. Audu and his friends are almost escaped, but were caught by the guards. These are the facts of the sheikh's death. If it pleases your lordship, call the guards, asked Barrister Sani Aruga, a tall elderly man wearing a worn-out wig. The guards appeared. One of them volunteered to represent all and so went into the witness box. Take the Quran in your right hand and repeat after me. I swear by Almighty Allah that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. The guard swore as he had been told. Why did you have to leave your master? Aren't you supposed to follow him to every nook and cranny he goes? Barrister Sani asked. Yes, he told us to go and assist the farmhands because there was much work to be done. But at least even one could have stayed with him, Barrister Sani said. He told us all to go because he least expected anything could happen. So by that, he took a risk, said Barrister Sani. The guard looked unsure and answered, Yes, sir, you can go. Sani Aruga gave his own facts of the case. My lord, members of the jury, this is a complete fabrication. Let us examine the evidence of the prosecution itself. What a bundle of contradictions. Are guards meant to work on the land? The late sheikh had hundreds of workers. How is it that five guards should go and assist? What difference will it make? I call the defense witness, Malam Zongo. After the swearing process, Barrister Sani questioned Malam Zongo. As a public prison officer, what were you doing in some hideouts near the scene of the death? Sani asked. My house is a few meters away from the wells, and one of my windows faced the well in the opposite direction, so I saw the scene from my window. What actually happened? The arrow was shot by the guards at Audu, but Audu bent down immediately, and the arrow went to the target destined by God. What other evidence does the court need? Audu is either seen looking after his mother or studying holy books. What offense has a boy committed to go drink from his father's wells, which are now his own? I was about to hang him when I recognized him. I cannot partake in injustice. I would like to go to my creator with clean hands.
Members of the jury, are you agreed on your verdict?
The registrar asked. We are agreed, the foreman of the jury replied.
Is it guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty. Audu's broken world began taking a new form. In this world, justice prevailed against injustice. His daydreams were interrupted by the judge's voice.
Audu Sabo, you have been given a fair trial and found not guilty. I, on behalf of Justice Mandori, apologize for wrong judgment in the first place. I promise that he will be properly dealt with, because an innocent soul would have been lost if not for the help of our veracious father, Malam Zango.
Court dismissed. The clerk ordered, and the joy of justice was written all over the face of everyone present.
Radio Phonics, Painful Exchange.
Ama, where are you? Remember Mama said for us to stay together. Ama! Ego's voice echoed out to me, urging me to come out from the bush. I was searching for what only God knows. All of a sudden, I turned and saw something. Ego, come and see what I have found. A fruit. She walked up to me. The cylindrical deep green fruit shone in my hand. It's so beautiful. We will have to show it to Mama. Come, let's go or Mama will be so worried about us. That was a dream I had a very long time ago. But I still remember it like it happened only yesterday. I had told it to Mama, who said with her insight into dreams that I was going to have a child. Useless, shameless woman. I think I have been patient enough. Stupid barren witch. You want me to die without having seen my grandchildren, eh? I have told my son to marry another wife. I don't know the type of charm you have used to hold him, but wait and see. I will break it. That explains what I have been passing through for all the years that I have been married to Uzo. My mother-in-law Ojugo never makes me feel welcome. She keeps repeating the insults. Her words cut into my heart like knives. Uzo, though, comforts me daily. I'm tired of all this. Why can't I just have a child? Why are the gods so heartless? Everywhere I turned, people whispered and pointed in my direction. Shh, quiet woman, and stop accusing the gods. They will bless you with a child at the right time, he said to me on a particular day. I felt I never deserved a man like Uzo, caring, loving, and hardworking. When I considered my childlessness, I felt unworthy of him. Oh, Uzo, why did you marry me? No, I must give him a child. He does not deserve to be punished. The day before I planned to go to Alakbu to beg Nwa, the god of fertility, to bless me with a child, Uzo came back from the farm earlier than before. I was sleeping when he came back. To my greatest surprise, someone had cooked that afternoon, and then he came into the hut quietly. He held me and I stood up. I asked if he had been in the house for long and apologized for having slept so much. You deserve it, he said and continued. Have you eaten? You look pale. Is anything the matter? No, I am all right. What food are you talking about? Did Mama cook before she left? I dare not touch the pot. I cooked, he said. I just sat there not knowing what to say. I knew he could cook as he had told me how he used to help his mother cook as an only child. Here was another problem for me. What if one of the village gossips saw him cook for me? Would they not say I not only charmed him into not marrying another woman, I also made him cook for me? Wouldn't they say I have turned him into my servant, second wife? I know my mother-in-law has thought about it. I don't know if she has already made preparations. I really needed a child. I contemplated. I will definitely go to Alakbu, but alone, and I will not tell anyone, not even Ego. She already had four boys. Whenever I saw them, I felt cursed by Nwa. That night, I told Uzo that I wanted to go to my maternal village to visit one of my aunts. My mother-in-law looked at me suspiciously when I left in the morning. She looked at me as if she had something in mind. I feared she was going to bring in another wife. Oh, what if I found another woman in the house on my return? Uzo cannot do this to me. I must go to Alakbu, I resolved, and beg to have a child. Any type of child, maimed, dumb or blind, let the village know that I was not a dry tree. A voice said, "My daughter, go back home." I shuffled forward, causing a stir in the bushes as I passed the forest. I felt thrilled. It took me a day to find Alaku, and with the help of others, I found the Dibia huddled in his shrine, close to the river Mmemme. The Dibia reminded me of the dream I had as a child and advised me to be patient. No, patience, not again. When my house is on fire, whatever the cost, I wanted a child now, I told him. If it will just appear now, I will take it along. Remember, my daughter, a patient dog will eat the fattest bone. Patience is what you need. I wasn't going to listen, so he told me to go to the river. River Mmemme wavered and emitted steam, steam that signified ascending sacrifices. The priestess Ezenwanyi was a tall, fair woman. She looked like she lived in the water and had a veil over her face. Her unusually dark cave had cowries, shells, hides, and fetishes hung everywhere. She told me she knew my mission and that I was being impatient. I told her that my husband needed a child, my mother-in-law needed a child, and that the whole village thought me to be barren. Hot tears dropped on my breast. I asked what I could do to have a child. I was to sacrifice a spotless white female goat and something very precious to me. She never stated what this was to be. At the door, she said, "Remember, it takes a life to make a life." Uttered a guttural laugh and disappeared. This was a statement I could not understand at that moment. I ran to the village Eke Market for the goat, which I took to Ezenwanyi. The goat did a show of resistance as I dragged. It screamed its guts out, but it moved. She understood my need for a child and pitied me. She made some incantations over the goat and threw it into the river. It flung itself desperately, bleated profusely, and with breathless kicking of hoofs went underwater. For the first time, I saw her face, which was covered with long hair, the pointed nose and the gap teeth. I felt she was more attractive than I was, in spite of the fact that I was considered the village beauty. According to legend, she was born in the river and dedicated to the river. After the ritual, I went back home a fulfilled woman. I felt I was already pregnant, for this goddess hardly failed. I had a meal waiting for Uzo before he arrived from the farm. When he arrived, he saw I was joyous and complimented me. 3 months later, I was a rounded body. I was so happy and yet did not tell my husband. It was Ojugo that noticed it one day when she saw me vomiting. She had seen a similar thing the previous day and understood the way women understand themselves. She came closer out of curiosity. "You must be pregnant, Ama. Why did you not tell me?" She embraced me and took me to her hut. This was only the second time in 7 years that I would enter her house. She gave me a sour, bitter-tasting concoction and some food to take. I slept afterwards. She must have told Uzo about it, for when I woke up, he was there by my side, beaming with satisfaction. Her treatment of me made me feel I had a mother, but this feeling did not last. One night in the 9th month of my pregnancy, Uzo announced that he was going hunting for game. The same night, I was caught in the pangs of childbirth. "Mama, oh!" I remember the dream now, vaguely as I pushed. Then she came out like fluid. "A girl," called one of the women. "You are now a woman," someone was saying, as I caught the frenzy of having become a mother. I had joined the league. I felt my mission on earth had been accomplished and was ready to die. On the other hand, Ojugo was saying how lucky she was to have a grandchild. In the morning, a crowd gathered in the compound, but it was not to celebrate. What was there to celebrate? My husband had not come back from his hunting. The lifeless body, a pale face, the rest of him hung limply on 2 shoulders. That was when I fainted. So Uzo was the sacrificial lamb after all. "We found his body in the forest and Eke, the python, close by," the carrier said. A python was the sacred messenger of the gods. the messenger of death itself. It takes a life to make a life. I remembered Ezewani's words, that if only the gods could take this child away now and give me back my Uzo. It was too late. My love, I wish the gods allowed you to see our daughter, even if for only 1 second. This is the guilt I have had to live with. This is the guilt that is killing me. The only joy is this growing daughter, who, though a pearl, compares poorly to my Uzo.
Radiophonics, Days of the Black Sun.
The heat gnawed at us. A thin coat of sweat trickled down my face. The low skies bled out a bulbous structure as we all gazed in anticipation of the arrival of the comet. A ball. A ball. Our only prized possession that promised a way out of war-torn Rwanda. Our only chance to play the game toe-to-toe, foot-to-foot, brain-to-brain with the Hutus. The ball. Hope. Two intertwined. I looked to see Sebahive, an opponent from the other team. His body danced with the ball, leaving most players on my side in awe. No reaction. Just like how we let the Hutus destroy us. No reaction. Habibana, do something, Gahiji pleaded. He was one of my closest friends, a sponge for my emotions. My head snapped back into position as I was called. Hope. There was a sudden surge coursing through my veins. I was a one-man army versus a stampede. I threw myself in front of the ball as I feigned a tackle. He recovered. 1 second. Think. I lunged with my 2 feet at the ball. I whipped up a sandstorm and the sand cascaded into my eyes. The ball was gone. Sebaive! Loud cheers. He leaned forward, then kicked the ball. The inevitable demise. You see, Habimana, your little gang of rookies can't touch us. We, the huge sharks, run this village. Habimana, you are a loser. Do not lie to yourself. Dismissed. Sebahive's voice, pure malice. No, I wouldn't take that. Not after years of hard work. My nose sticking into book after book? No. I was going to be the best medical doctor in Rwanda. No, Sebahive. In me is the best medical doctor Rwanda has ever produced. I flashed a set of white teeth. Good luck with that. It will never happen. Don't you know what's going on? He read the blank expression on my face. Oh, maybe your papa, our chief, didn't want you to know. His whole gang jeered. Hot lava bubbled inside me. Sometimes, when I look at this day at the pitch, it was really an eye-opener. Shards of hope were as scarce as a miracle there. When I reminisce, throwing my mind back 5 years to the football pitch, this was the least the Hutus could do to us. The worst was yet to come. Habimana, where have you been? It's no longer safe. I'm disappointed you came so late. I will not take this. It is just irresponsible. From today onwards, you will not leave the huts without my consent. Rwanda is not safe. Papa's words were thin and razor sharp. There was a momentary pause. I wasn't sad. I loved Papa for this, always looking out for me. Mama shot Papa a glance. Papa, I will heed your advice, but I will also like to know what is going on. Mama still hadn't released her gaze. Papa broke the silence. Habimana. My name hung in the air. There was a ripple through the huts. What was going on? Pandemonium reigned. People ran out of huts, licked by fire. Straw roofs ignited. Heat embraced me. People wailed. Children like me, then 11 years, were running. Human torches. Father, do something. You are the chief. My voice was frantic. His eyes were pale green. I'd never seen him scared. His mouth curved around one word. Hutus. I gasped. Tears flushed Mama's face. Her soft eyes and beautiful caramel skin were pale. Another cry hit the air. What were the Hutus doing? I couldn't take any more. I pulled my lab coat off the mahogany stool and ran forward toward the nearest hut. I gasped. A thick blade was pumping furiously, up, swiftly and viciously, and down, sharp and vigorous. Death stank in the air. Dingisayo! A herd of villagers began running, stampede, sands lashing everywhere. A string of them was lined up outside our hut. I remember thinking, why would the Hutus invade us? I thought we shared power. Us, Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa. Voices called out from nowhere. It even seemed as if their cries were cloaked by the night. Cockroaches scurry to hide when they see their superiors. Bow for us, Tutsi, they jested. Cockroaches, they hissed. A bullet whizzed through the air and missed me by inches. But we were not all lucky. The bullet had landed squarely in the frail man's chest. He let out a squeal, then died. Papa turned to me, his eyes narrow and grave. Leave now. Run away to a church or a school. You will be safe there. Don't trust anyone. Life isn't fair. I love you. Tears streamed down my father's face. Mama turned to me. She stroked my cheeks. Shockwaves triggered tears as my vision suddenly became blurred. This isn't goodbye. You will see, my son. It is not right for a mother to leave her son, but I love you. Never forget that. Go, Papa urged. I ran towards the bush and I hid for what seemed to be an eternity. I had a plain, full view of the village. The Hutus had revealed themselves. The Machet commenced their butchering. I saw death. Death saw me. We stared eyeball to eyeball. My people. Mother, was she safe? A woman who carried me for 9 months, who had felt every ache in my body as her own. Time froze. I felt my face contort. Anger mixed with grief paralyzed me. There was nothing for me to do. At that point, I heard a faint cry. My mother's cry. I ran to the hut. Mama! Don't move, cockroach! The Hutu soldier shouted as he turned to me. His left hand tapped a semi-automatic tucked in the back of his trouser. Mama! I ran forwards, trying to pull the man off her. Mother! I love you, Habimana. She spat out blood. Blood ran down Mama's body. She was dying. She released a smile, and I knew what she meant. I grabbed the semi-automatic tucked behind his back. His back arced as he swung the machet at me. The gun felt hot in my hands. I had never killed a man before. It would just make me like them. He swung it again, and I fired. I saw his body go limp as he crashed into the ground. His dark eyes rolled back. I threw the gun away. Mama! She replied with a deafening silence. The tears flowed faster. I ran for what was left of my life. Hours ago, I had parents. In seconds, I had lost everything. What had happened suddenly hit me. I was alone in the world, the real world. My mind was scarred. Images flickered in my head. Mother, father, the village, the gun, the man I had killed. White hot lava ran through me. I threw my body against the sand. Revenge, revenge. But revenge would make me just like them. I walked aimlessly in the fierce heat for what seemed like days. Then something caught my eye. A road. I pressed forward, mustering all the energy I could. There was a roadblock. Lights. I moved closer. My heart found its place in my throat. Dead bodies were piled up, one after the other. My eyes widened. My nose flared. Tutsi bodies. There was no more they could do to me. My life had no meaning. We were fighting a one-sided war. Hutu versus Tutsi. Rather, Hutus versus cockroaches. Indeed, that was what we were, with no means of resistance. We begged to be trampled on. What war was this? I wasn't fast enough, and the explosion threw me. I staggered to my feet. A jolt of pain stabbed me. The bullet hit its mark. Darkness. Then sirens filled the air. opened my eyes. A white fluorescent light shone brightly. A man perched over me. He was white and in army uniform. I jumped. He smiled cheerfully. "You are safe. Is it over?" "No, son, but there is hope." He touched my bandaged arm where the bullet had grazed me. The low skies bled out a bulbous sun. We all gazed in anticipation of the arrival of the comet. A ball. A ball. Our only prized possession that promised a way out of war-torn Rwanda. Our only chance to play the game toe-to-toe, foot-to-foot, brain-to-brain with the Hutus. The ball. Hope. Two intertwined.
Radiophonics is a Flint Studios production for the British Council.